So I'm very pleased to be here today on this topic of international health and human rights. IPPF has spent a great deal of time developing this, which is our Declaration of Sexual Rights, which is work that we've done trying to put human rights structure onto the area of sexuality. And this directly goes into my discussion today, which is I want to talk to you a little bit about our work that we began 5 years ago working on sexual diversity issues in Latin America and the Caribbean. So I work for International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF. It's a global organization based out of London. We have 6 regions around the world. I work in the New York office, and this is the region that we cover from New York. We have 40 member associations, and these are autonomous organizations. In the last year, they provided 15 million sexual and reproductive health services. So we're one of the world's largest service providers in sexual and reproductive health. The mission of IPPF is to really ensure that people's sexual and reproductive rights are respected. We do this through service provision, through advocacy work. We do a lot of work with young people. We do support a woman's right to choose when and whether or not she would like to have children. And we strive to eliminate sexually transmitted infections and HIV around the world. So today's learning objectives, I'm a really practical person, and so I like practical presentations. My goal for today is that you can walk away thinking about how you can put working with sexually diverse populations into your own work, not like, ooh, look what IPPF does, isn't that interesting? I hope you find it interesting, but I actually would prefer that you implement something in your own work. To that end, my learning objective for today is that I'd like to identify some of the key components for a comprehensive model to improve sexual and reproductive health services for sexually diverse populations, and also discuss the important role that sexual and reproductive health service providers and health organizations more broadly can play in respecting the rights of sexually diverse populations. So two key concepts. The first is the concept of sexual rights, and what was mentioned before is that human rights play a really critical role in the way that we provide health services. And we are really functioning at IPPF from several principles, but one is that we really view sexuality as an integral part of each human being's life. And in discussing sexual diversity, it always helps to give a definition. I think practically, it often does end up meaning that we're talking about LGBTQI, I don't know, I'll shorten to LGBT. But really what we were trying to aim for in our work in sexual diversity was looking at a full range of sexuality, which includes all aspects of behavior, attitudes, relationships. And we wanted to really take a broad perspective when thinking about our work with sexual diversity. So 5 years ago, we started projects, and we were a little bit scared. We traditionally have family planning organizations that work on sexual and reproductive health, and the question was like, well, why should we work with these communities? We really work with women of reproductive health, and we said, well, because there's a lot of stigma and discrimination, we have the opportunity to provide an answer and to really push forward with a really progressive agenda where we can meet the health needs of people who are often underserved. I don't want to go into the details of each of the countries, but just to say they all took a very different approach, but I'm going to talk to you about some of the key components that went across in each country. We know that issues in sexual diversity are linked to health outcomes, and unfortunately, they're often negative health outcomes. We know that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals in developed countries often suffer negative health outcomes in a variety of areas, from mental health, suicide attempts, obesity, tobacco use, and these are all broad health issues that need to be addressed. Often the focus around sexual diversity is sort of HIV, STI prevention, but really these are complete individuals who need to sort of look at a broad range of their health needs and outcomes. In a study in Mexico City, we found that while only 7% of the regular population reports experiencing violence, my guess is it's much higher, that lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth reported 16% reported experiencing violence and 58% reported experiencing verbal violence. We also read into some studies before we began this work, and we found that in Nicaragua, one survey said that 85% of people felt that there was no excuse at all for any kind of same-sex intercourse. In Venezuela and in Mexico, over half of the respondents felt that there was no justifiable reason for homosexuality. And one LGBT organization we worked with in Mexico had reported 164 murders of lesbian and gays in Mexico between 1995 and 1998, which is a gross underestimation, they think, but still that number is quite high. So we know the stigma and discrimination in the region where I work is very high, and we know in other regions where IPPF works, such as in Africa, people finding out that you're a homosexual can be punishable by death, and the same is true in other regions where we work. So getting into the programmatic piece, we really saw that there was five key components into bringing about institutional change. You can't just sort of wake up in the morning and think like, let's go work with sexually diverse populations and make it happen. You really have to think about really a long-term institutional change so that when that one champion leaves the organization is still committed to this work. So you need to build the institutional commitment and leadership, build the capacity to actually provide the services, make the services accessible and appropriate, and then, of course, increasing public awareness and advocacy, and then finally finding ways to monitor and evaluate this work. In the back, I've left a postcard. In this project, one of the best things I think that came out of it was we created a sexual diversity toolkit, and it's a really great toolkit with several different tools aimed to help organizations really assess the readiness of your organization to enter into this kind of work, how to evaluate using indicators, you know, where your organization is, how to create action plans. We created a 45-minute webcast that everyone's welcome to use, and so there's postcards in the back, but I encourage you to take a look. So in phase one, we were working on building the institutional commitment and leadership, and we really felt that it was important to secure buy-in from all levels of the organization. Often you will have a champion who believes in LGBT issues, believes in having a more open attitude towards a broad variety of sexuality, and when that person leaves the organization, things can fall apart. So we really went in with an idea of like, let's create sort of institutions that believe in this. And we wanted to develop clearly defined institutional positions on sexual diversity, meaning that institutions had to have an opportunity to sit down and create a dialogue around what they really envision this work being. And then, of course, conducting a readiness assessment. Where is your organization in terms of being able to open services to a broader variety of clients? And then creating an action plan with a clear timeline. And this timeline for some of our organizations for service provision was several years, and for some it was several months. I mean, it can vary significantly. In phase two is building the capacity to provide appropriate and high-quality services. And the first thing that we did was we went out to the communities. We knew that we were actually primarily serving women of reproductive age in primarily heterosexual relationships. And so what we did was we went out to the communities we thought that we would be serving and began to ask questions. We conducted focus groups. We asked them questions about what kind of services they felt they needed. Were they comfortable coming into our clinics? Why weren't they comfortable? And that helped us a lot in sort of figuring out how to move forward. And then also assessing the staff attitudes, knowledge, and intended behaviors. Our own staff had a lot of stigma and discrimination. They felt a fair amount of morality judgments about people expressing things that were outside of the normative sort of heterosexual behavior. And we really needed to work on values clarification through training, and then talk about how to counsel. And then we had to talk about rights. Like, even if you don't agree with the behavior, there's a fundamental basis in which we all agree that we will respect and not discriminate against people's sexual rights. And that became our sort of key message and component. And we could have people who fundamentally felt that certain behaviors were wrong, and they said, I'm a service provider and I will provide service without discrimination to these populations. And it was a process to get people there. Preparing the institutional environment, we thought about the waiting rooms, the kind of educational materials we provided, and creating protocols for service delivery. And then, of course, creating partnerships with other organizations became critical for us. So making the services accessible and appropriate, we had to figure out if we wanted to have separate services initially or if we wanted them integrated into our regular service provision. And a lot of this decision making came from feedback from the communities we wanted to serve. So if it was commercial sex workers, if it was men having sex with men, we went to them and said, you know, would you be more comfortable if we had certain hours that would be more convenient to when you're working or when you would like services? Would you like a certain type of provider to meet with you? And then we had to do service promotion. It's not like build it and they will come. I think Kevin Costner had it wrong. I think you have to actually go out and grab people and say, we have these services, we want you to come here. We did Facebook text messaging and get peer educators from those communities so that they're not hearing from, you know, somebody who doesn't look like them, hasn't lived like them, but that they are hearing from people from within their own community. And then, of course, building referral networks for the services that we would be unable to provide. And then phase four was really increasing public awareness and advocacy. We didn't want this to happen in a vacuum. We wanted to be leaders in where IPPF works generally. Our organizations are the leaders in sexual and reproductive health. And we wanted them to be leaders and champions for the issue of sexual diversity. So we asked them to engage when possible in supporting policies and legislative change to ensure that these populations could have their rights respected. If there was no existing legislation, we tried to think about where we could implement or push forward policies that would be supportive. And then reducing stigma and discrimination at a broader public awareness level, there needed to be more education in a broader sense so that we could really ensure that we weren't just creating change in a small way, but that we were having an impact in a broader sense. And then, of course, cross-cutting issue is always monitoring and evaluating. And this is very difficult. You're asking people sometimes to identify themselves in a setting that's highly stigmatizing and sometimes very dangerous. And sort of evaluating whether or not they're working. We found that like mystery clients worked really well, focus groups could work really well. So we had to be a little bit creative. It wasn't as easy as sort of creating indicators and then being able to measure it easily. So the outcomes were quite positive, although we have a long way to go. There's increased numbers of health professionals who are trained and able to meet the needs of sexual diverse populations. We've had really explicit promotion and inclusion of sexually diverse populations. Our organization in Mexico has like, in the waiting room, a poster where it says sexual diversity and it has like the rainbow of everybody, and inside, like, you know, the fifth one is like heterosexuals, and then they just include everybody sort of the same. It's not like you guys are over here and the rest of like the normal people are, you know, don't need a poster. They've really tried to make it an inclusive thing, which I think is speaks a lot to sort of where people have been and where we're trying to go. And then development of active partnerships and referral networks with other organizations. IPPF is not the first organization to work on this topic, and in fact, we're entering the game pretty late in the game in some ways. So what we did is we looked for allies and people who had been working on these issues for a long time and asked how we could support them and how we could use where our expertise was to sort of further these efforts. In IPPF regionally, we have this work included in our five-year strategic plan and, of course, in the Declaration of Sexual Rights, which we're promoting very actively. So the lessons that we learned was this importance of collaborating with local organizations, with LGBT organizations, and making sure that we are supporting their missions and activities and that we're not actually coming in as sort of a huge organization and trying to take over something that has been being worked on for a long time. And then the importance of tailoring each of these steps into the local context was really important. We couldn't do the same work in Suriname that we could do in Mexico, that we could do in Peru, and so we had to think about how to really make sure that we were able to tailor each program. And it was, I think the tools are broad enough that it's really easy to do, and if you're flexible enough, the organizations can kind of lead you in the direction they need to go. And that also we recognize that each step is vital. You can't skip to service provision without first doing the values clarification, without first thinking about where are you as an organization. Often we like to think that we're much further along than we are, or maybe we think we're so far away we could never possibly get that far. I can say in 5 years, these were organizations that absolutely were not reaching out to these communities. They did not have contacts with many of these communities. And in 5 years, we've seen huge institutional changes. There hasn't been a huge spike in service provision necessarily, but there has been a change where people feel much more comfortable accessing services. And I'd say that 5 years is an okay time frame to really make change happen in these countries. So of course the challenges, people feel uncomfortable talking about sexuality. Whenever I say things like, well, I work in gender rights and sexuality, it's like I can talk about gender and rights all day long, and then once I start talking about sexuality, people start avoiding eye contact with me. I understand it. It's uncomfortable, and many people are trained clinicians. They don't really want to talk about sexual behaviors or practices that they may not feel comfortable with. So it was a challenge for us. Data collection was also a challenge, figuring out how to collect data of who we were reaching, especially when many of these communities are hidden. They don't want to be identified. And then limited client feedback. We were able to get a significant client feedback in some countries, and in others we struggled with that. And then evaluating the impact of the work is a process that we're still engaged in and we're still working on. And then transitioning from sort of a disease approach to a more holistic approach. I think many times when people are working with sexually diverse populations, it's in HIV projects, in STI reduction projects, and in sort of in disease prevention. But what we really wanted to do was say, like, you can have a safe space here. You can come here and talk to us about a broad range of health and sexual issues that you might be concerned with, and not just focus on them only through the lens of disease prevention. But it's not an easy transition. And then stigma and discrimination within political, religious, and cultural forces. I mean, we often, when you work in developing countries or anywhere in the world, including in the United States, you come into contact with people who are very, very against you trying to work with these populations because they think you're saying that it's okay for them to be this way, even though it is okay for them to be this way. I think it's important that we confront this and that we do move forward, but it is a challenge to be respectful and also continue to move forward. In conclusion, I think IPPF and all of our organizations really reflect the societies we work in, and sometimes we have to be a better reflection of the societies that we work in. And while we might not see this as our role because we think other organizations are working with these populations, that I think it's important we take the time to think about how we can include some of these populations into our work so that we can all sort of move forward together and make sure that sexual reproductive health and healthcare more generally includes all people. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them through my email. And you can also visit our website if you'd like a copy of any of the resources I mentioned. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kate, for that very interesting presentation. And I think the topics and what Kate touched about, the points in her presentation, we have faced, you know, during our careers, and we will continue to face them. So this needs to be addressed. And one of the biggest challenges is in some countries, it's like, I'm sure you found that, so many of you have found that in your work, it's so hard to reach out to this population because they're like totally suppressed and oppressed. And the fear, if they come out, they could even be killed or, you know, their families could be in harm. So that is something really. And yesterday I was watching in the hotel a rerun of Law and Order, and in the interest of disclosure, they're not paying me to talk about that. But I thought it was really interesting because some of the issues they focused about, and this was the special victims unit, was about the killing, the brutal killing of a gay person who was stepping out with his partner. And when the alleged killer was being interrogated, and his mother, she goes like, I train my son to be good and proper and not hang out with those queer people, you know. And so it's like, you know, the way the terms we use, the phrases we use, it's so discriminatory. So thank you so much. And I would like to invite Manisha.